Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 25th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Julie Anderson. Session number is 98-3 and is titled Justice in Central America.
Otherwise known as WCCN, so I'll refer to the organization now as WCCN. And I have been to Nicaragua. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. WCCN is based in Madison, Wisconsin. That's the world headquarters, where all three of the staff people that work for WCCN are located, except for we do have one consultant working for us in Nicaragua about three-quarter time right now. And I will get into a little bit more about what it is our programs do later on in this discussion. And I want to encourage all of you to really participate. I would like this to be a discussion. We're going to talk today about the title of the session is Peace and Justice in Central in Nicaragua. And it's a question mark because is there now what's happening in regards to peace and justice in Nicaragua? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history, a little bit about what's going on now, and then what are some possible roles for solidarity or for support of the people in Nicaragua right now. Let me give you just a brief introduction to my organization first, and then we're going to take a quiz. So we're not going to score you on it, but just to kind of see what folks know about Nicaragua. WCCN, the Wisconsin Coordinating Council of Nicaragua, for those of you who just came in, was formed in 1984, and building on the historic sister state relationship between Wisconsin and Nicaragua, which was part of the Alliance for Progress, Partners of America program, started in the 1960s. But my organization was not formed until 1984 in the midst of the Contra War against Nicaragua. And it was formed to provide the people of Wisconsin a more constructive way to relate to the people of Nicaragua than was being offered by the U.S. government at that time. And it's based on the philosophy of citizen diplomacy, which basically means that people are more effective at relating to each other than governments are. And so all of our work from the 1980s through now are based on that philosophy and that principle, although the work that we have done has changed over those 14 years. And I'll get into that later on. But now we're going to have a little quiz. And so I just want you to shout out the answer if you think you know what the answer is. First of all, what continent is Nicaragua on?
Central.
Oh, very good. We're starting out well here. So what countries border Nicaragua?
Honduras.
Costa Rica.
And one more?
El Salvador.
El Salvador, right. With the Pacific on the west and the Atlantic or the Caribbean on the east. El Salvador and Honduras are to the north and Costa Rica are to the south. And some of you are thinking, why are we starting out so basic? Because a lot of people don't know exactly where Nicaragua is, and I'd like to orientate us for that. Does anybody know what the capital is?
Managua.
All right. Okay, here's a little bit more complicated question. In the 1980s, the World Court found the United States of America, guilty of a crime against Nicaragua and ordered them to pay $17 billion to Nicaragua for that crime. Does anybody know what that crime was?
What?
The crime was the U.S. committed against Nicaragua.
We just talked about it yesterday next door, otherwise I wouldn't know. But mining the harbors, I think, was the Sandinista government took over.
Right, exactly. Mining the harbors of Nicaragua. And that was a crime against international law, and the World Court found the U.S. guilty, and the U.S. promptly ignored that finding. And do you know if the U.S. ever paid the fine?
Probably not.
No. Mm-hmm. They asked why Nicaragua would do it.
Pardon?
Were they asked to do it by the former government?
They were. They were found guilty in the 1980s when the Sandinistas were in power in Nicaragua. And then in 1990, Violeta Chamorro was elected president, and she forgave that debt She was also, during the election, she received a lot of support from the U.S. government. It was kind of a political figure. Yeah.
What year was that they mined the harbor?
Did you talk about it yesterday? I forgot.
Just real briefly. Yeah, I don't remember what year it was.
60s, 70s, what were you?
It was 80s. 1980s. I think it was in the, wow. Like in the mid-1980s, around 85, somewhere around there. Yeah.
Has those mines been removed then?
Yes,
are they still existing or some are?
I believe the mines from the harbor have been removed. There are still mines throughout parts of Nicaragua. Yeah, they're landmines. This is Nicaragua. I didn't want to put it up because I didn't want people to be able to read it for the quiz. Yeah, right up here in that area. And throughout the mountainous region of Nicaragua goes right through here. And there are throughout that area a number of mines.
Can you put those in?
Both the Sandinistas and the Contra put it in. Those mines supplied by the Contra are still there. Most of the Sandinista ones have been removed because they try to keep track of where they were putting them.
Yeah.
Not always did they do that though. Okay, here's another question. In the early 1990s, it was finished in 1993, there was a new cathedral built in Nicaragua. And the cost of a little over $5 million. Who was the largest donor for the construction of this cathedral? And we'll give you a multiple choice here. Umberto Belli, who is currently and at the time was the Minister of Education, like the Ministry of Education is like our department in our government here, and he is part of a right-wing Catholic sect called Opus Dei. So that's choice A. B. The Vatican. C. Domino's Pizza. D. Bill Gates.
Oh my God.
Any guesses?
The Vatican.
Domino's Pizza.
Oh, I can't believe it.
Moynihan, actually the owner. That's a little bit cheap because it wasn't actually Domino's Pizza itself that gave the money. It was the owner of Domino's Pizza. Moynihan, his last name, I've forgotten his first name. He gave, it cost a little over $5 million, he gave about $4.5 million for the construction of that cathedral. Just to tell a little story around that, there's an old cathedral in Managua, and it's in the old center of downtown, the old center of Managua. It was destroyed in the 1972 earthquake, which devastated most of Managua, and 10,000 people were killed. And millions of dollars of aid poured into the country, almost none of which got to the people of the country. Most of it was taken by the dictator, Anastasio Somoza. And but that structure still stands. Well, nobody did anything about it in the 1970s, and in the 1980s it came up, well, isn't it time for Nicaragua to have a new cathedral? And the cardinal of the area, I'm not real familiar with Catholic hierarchies, but the Cardinal of Nicaragua, Cardinal Obando y Bravo, told the Vatican and told people who would have been able to help finance, no, Nicaragua doesn't deserve a cathedral now because the Nicaraguan people are supporting the Sandinistas, and so they are not worthy of a cathedral. So it wasn't until the 1990s, and there was a government more appealing to the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in that area, that Nicaragua was given a new cathedral.
What was Bravo's reason again?
That they were supporting, as he called it, a communist government. The Sandinistas were not communist, but many people have called them communist. Yeah. And so the Nicaraguan people were not worthy then of a cathedral in the eyes of the Catholic hierarchy. And one last question for the quiz. Does anybody know who this person is?
Sandino.
Augusto Cesar Sandino. And that'll take us into our brief history lesson. If any of you were here Thursday, we talked more extensively about the history of Nicaragua, and we're just gonna go over it briefly now. In the 1920s and early 30s, Sandino led a group of armed rebels an army, I guess, at the time, in protection of nationalist interests of Nicaragua, because the U.S. was making a lot of efforts to control the resources of Nicaragua. And so Sandino was a nationalist and was fighting against that. And in 1934, after most of the other generals in Nicaragua, at that time there was no national army. It was divided, Nicaragua was divided into like little small areas, and there were generals that then that would control different areas of Nicaragua. And so Sandino was in charge of one of those areas in the Segovias up here. And all the generals pretty much came to an agreement, okay, we're not going to form a national army, and we're gonna try to protect more of the national interest. And he came to sign a treaty at that time in 1934, and he was assassinated. Sandino was assassinated. And then the National Guard was formed with help from the United States. A man named Anastasio Somoza was put in charge of the National Guard. He's a Harvard graduate. He actually also acted as a translator for the U.S. representative who was helping him negotiate everything with Nicaragua at the time. And so he was named general of the new National Guard. And then in 1936, he became president of Nicaragua. And for the next 40-some years, the Somoza family was basically ran a dictatorship over Nicaragua. It was known, had an international reputation for being very brutal. And here's a little quiz. For those of you who yesterday don't answer this one, here's another new question in the quiz. Is who said about Somoza, he might be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch?
Sounds like Helms.
Could have been.
Who was it?
Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Yeah.
He said he, so he was a tyrant, but at least he was in the pocket of the U.S. interests, and so the U.S. government was friendly towards him. It was a brutal dictatorship, as I said, very, very cruel. The National Guard and the Somoza family pretty much reigned over the whole country. As I mentioned before, there was an earthquake in 1972, which devastated Managua. The National Guard and the Somoza family were the ones that benefited from then all the international aid. Practically all of the international aid that came into Nicaragua to help the people at that time. In the 1960s, the Sandinista Party was formed, the Sandinista Movement was formed, named after Sandino and his ideas of nationalism. In 1979, much to their own surprise, as well as everybody else's, they marched into Managua triumphant, having overthrown the dictator, Somoza, who had left 2 days earlier. A bunch of young people in their 20s and 30s who had never really run much of anything before, except for this army, and now all of a sudden they're in charge of a country, did amazing things. Literacy campaigns have turned around the literacy rate from more illiterates to a very low literacy rate, and health brigades, agrarian reform, amazing things that took place throughout the country and that were recognized by the United Nations, by the international community, but not recognized by the United States government. And so starting in 1981 at least, or probably even a little bit earlier, the Contra War was being waged against Nicaragua. The Contras started out as people from the National Guard who had left Nicaragua and didn't want to give up their power. And so the CIA worked with the National Guard, particularly starting in Honduras, later also working with them from Costa Rica, and waged war against the government of Nicaragua, the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. But not only the government, also the people of Nicaragua. They used a tactic called low-intensity warfare. Jack Nelson Palmyre, if any of you are familiar with him, has written a book called War Against the Poor, Low-Intensity Conflict in the War in Central America. And so the U.S. government spent money to train the Contras how to have a war against the people of Nicaragua. by such things as blowing up schools, blowing up health centers, blowing up power stations, and terrorizing the people, obstructing the activities of agricultural cooperatives, just a whole number of things that they did. And so throughout the 1980s, that war was waged. Millions of dollars from the United States put into that. All heard of the Iran-Contra affair, Ali North, all part of that whole picture in the war against Nicaragua. In 1990, there were elections that were held. And there had also been elections earlier in the 80s, which Daniel Ortega, as the Sandinista candidate, won. It through free and fair elections that were observed by international observers. And in 1990, there were elections again. Following a year or so of out-of-control inflation, around 33,000%, as well as 10 years of war, the Nicaraguan people were tired of that. And they knew if they voted for Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas, that they would be in for more years of war. And so that was probably one of the largest reasons that they voted for Violeta Chamorro, who became president in 1990 with help from backing from the United States government. She turned out to be not quite as much of a puppet as the United States government had hoped for, but still was much more compliant to the interests of the U.S. government than the Sandinistas had ever been. And in 1993, then, in the United States, there was a law passed called the Helms-Gonzalez Bill. And that is a bill that applies to all countries, but is directed at Nicaragua. And it is in regards to property issues. In the 1980s, there was agrarian reform, distributing the land confiscated from cronies of Somoza, contemporaries of Somoza, his buddies, and National Guard folks, and they confiscated that land, redistributed it to smaller farmers and agricultural cooperatives, and some of those people left and became U.S. citizens. Very few people who had their land confiscated were U.S. citizens at the time. But this law, the Helms-Gonzalez law, says that any U.S. citizen, whether you're a citizen at the time of the confiscation or become a citizen later, must be compensated for your property before that country can receive any U.S. assistance. So Nicaragua has people who left, had their land confiscated, and might become a U.S. citizen tomorrow. They could go back to Nicaragua and say, you have to compensate me. I'm a U.S. citizen. Your country will not receive any U.S. aid until I'm compensated. There's actually been a waiver signed every year by President Clinton so that Nicaragua, as long as Nicaragua is making progress in compensating these people, that they can continue to receive aid. And then in 1996, there were elections again. And Violeta Chamorro did not run for re-election, but a man named Arnoldo Alemán, who was the mayor of Managua from 1990 to 96, or 95 anyway, he ran for president against Daniel Ortega and about six or seven other candidates. I don't remember exactly how many. There were more than 20 different political parties registered, and there were fronting candidates in that elections for various offices. And Alemán won that election. He is from the Liberal Party in Nicaragua. Now, liberal does not mean the same thing throughout most of Central America as it does here. Liberal, we think of Democrats. But liberal in Nicaragua is a more conservative party. It's more to the right. If we're looking at a political spectrum, it's more on the right. And in this case, very much on the right. It's the party of Somoza, the dictator. And Alemán has adopted many of Somoza philosophies of concentration of wealth among a few hands. So that's a little bit of the history, brings us up to 1996. Again, I want to encourage, if you have questions as we go along, please ask. If you have things that you want to contribute, you know something you want to add, please do so. So now we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on today. We'll try to talk about some politics, about the church, about economics, the environment, education, and the women's movement. And then we'll talk a little bit more about what can we do here in the United States to support the people of Nicaragua? Well, as I mentioned, 1996, there were elections, and Alemán was voted in. And the FSLN, the Sandinista Party, also, they ran Daniel Ortega as the candidate for president. He lost. But the FSLN still has the largest block of any one party in the National Assembly, which is like our Congress. And but they do not have a majority within in the National Assembly, so they have to look for alliances with other parties to be able to get to pass bills that they're interested in. And so the Liberal Party, and there's it's a coalition of liberal parties, there's not just one liberal party, there's several liberal parties, have a very strong influence in the politics of the country right now. And like I said, it's running on cronyism. Alemán, when he was running for president, promised a lot of political favors to people. Well, if you support me, you run my back, I'll run your back, type of thing. And so when he took office in January of 1997, people who had been in their jobs, in governmental jobs, for 6 years, 5 years, boom, they were out the door. And people who didn't know anything about what they were supposed to be doing were put in because Alemán owed them a favor. Recently, there was another split in the liberal coalition, and somebody who was in the National Assembly, he spoke out against Alemán. His son was the UN delegate for Nicaragua to the UN, and as soon as he split from the Liberal Party, he called his son and said, "Pack your bags, a split from Alemán, he's going to be booting you out," and he did, like that. So it's not what you know, obviously, it's who you know and who you're connected to, and that's what's making Nicaragua run right now. And interesting connection with that is the narco-jet scandal, which has recently hit Nicaragua. A jet, a Learjet, was missing from Miami, turned up 6 months later or 5 months later in Nicaragua. And they call it the narco jet. And this jet, it was brought in, and because it was designated a presidential jet, because it was a presidential jet, nobody looked at it or inspected it. It was flying drugs supposedly from Colombia to Nicaragua to El Salvador to Costa Rica, flown several different places, and nobody was checking it out because it was the presidential jet. So that's the type of thing that is going on in Nicaragua. Another example of that will lead us into economics is taxes. Now there are people in the 1980s, taxes were levied, but nobody really paid them. There wasn't a real good system of paying and collecting taxes. And so now companies and businesses pay taxes to the local municipality or the local region where they are. Well, in Estelí is a Sandinista-controlled area. It's a Sandinista mayor and council that controls that area. And this is Estelí right here, this little yellow area. And there are a lot of cigar factories now there. A lot of Miami Cubans have come into Nicaragua. They were in Nicaragua in the 1960s and 70s. They had left Cuba when the revolution took over there. And they went to Nicaragua, and then when the revolution took over in Nicaragua, they left, came back then in the 1990s. And they set up these tobacco farms. So now instead of people in the area growing basic grains for the people in the country, they're growing tobacco, which is very hard in the environment. And they have cigar factories around in Esteli, all over the place. Well, that's high, a very lucrative business, but they're not paying their taxes to Esteli, where they're supposed to be paying their taxes, because it's a Sandinista-controlled government there. They are paying their taxes, but they pay it to the federal government. So Esteli, even though it has a very lucrative base, they're not benefiting, the local area's not benefiting from it at all. And so the rules are bent according to who you know and what your connections are. So let's talk a little bit more about economics. As I mentioned, in the 1980s, inflation was around 33,000% for a while. Well, one of Violeta Chamorro's great accomplishments in the early 1960s is she controlled inflation. So it's the Cordoba is the currency, and it goes out the one Cordoba a year to the dollar. So when I first went to Nicaragua in 1993, it was 6 Cordobas to the dollar. In February, it was 10 Cordobas to the dollar. May, it was about 10.4 to the dollar. So it's, you know, it's a little bit of inflation, but it's about 12% a year. But it's not bad, considering 33%. Read an article in the Chicago Tribune recently, and so it says that Nicaragua's looking up. The inflation is stabilized, and exports are up, and gross domestic product is up. So things should be looking pretty good. And the best sign for Nicaragua is that McDonald's is reinvesting in Nicaragua. And McDonald's just opened up this month in Nicaragua. Now, any of you were in Nicaragua in the 1980s, you're probably just shocked to think of a McDonald's opening up in Nicaragua, because true to their form, Sandinistas were very much into nationalism and promoting national types of products, and so any chains were not allowed. So the Chicago Tribune says, okay, well, Nicaragua's looking pretty good. Well, I'm not sure who that all is benefiting, because the poverty rate is between 70% and 80%, according to the United Nations Development Development Project. Between 70% and 80% of the population are poor, and of that, 80% are in extreme poverty. The un- and underemployment rate is from 60% to 90%. It's 90% in the Atlantic Coast region of the country, which is very different from the Pacific Coast region. About 10% of the population lives here. They speak English and Miskito, which is an indigenous language, and then the rest of the population, 90%, lives in these two-thirds of the country. And that's where unemployment is about 60% to 70%. So it's not, you know, that kind of prosperity is not really affecting a lot of people in Nicaragua. The annual income in Nicaragua, the average annual income is $468 a year. And the average market basket per year, a market basket, it's like the cost of living, is what it costs to support a family of 6, basic foods and soap and rent and utilities and all that. And that's $1,650 a year. So even if you have 2 breadwinners in the family, it's a hard one to meet.
Is there a barter system? I understand in many of these third world countries, much of their livelihood comes from barter, which doesn't get measured in right. the calculation of $800.
Right, exactly. Because if you just go by this, people would be dying right and left. Exactly. People are very creative in how they put things together. And so some bartering goes on. Yeah, like, well, I have a little extra gasoline over here. My car's broke down. I can't use it, but I'll trade you this for, you know, a sack of beans. So that kind of thing goes on. And so it doesn't get counted right in the gross domestic product, but it helps people survive. Trading services. And a lot more barter. There's not much of a cash economy at all in the Atlantic Coast region. They don't use money so much. So. So that's true. That's how people do survive. But there's a big building boom. If you go to Managua, I don't know, has anybody been to recently?
Not since 94.
You'd be surprised to go back 4 short years later. The amazing changes in Managua. Probably at that time I don't know if there's even a Pizza Hut at that time. There's 3 or 4 Pizza Huts now. There are subways. There's a Texaco or an Esso station every mile or so in Managua. It's an amazing change. But again, you know, it makes Managua look a little more like it's in the 1990s. But it's not I don't know how many people get to participate in what those
still as many squatters and
Yes, there are huge squatter settlements right in the middle of the city. Remember we talked about the earthquake in 72 devastated Managua. Well, there are huge areas of land in the middle of Managua that are just vacant.
All over, though, in the early 90s, because even the trip from the airport in past the embassies and stuff, and between the embassies, it was just everywhere.
Yeah,
a
exactly.
Huge influx of poor.
Right, and they keep coming. Keep coming. This year will probably be even worse because there's been a severe drought in Nicaragua. El Nino that has brought the Midwest anyway, a very pleasant year, has brought a lot of damage to Nicaragua. They had some flash floods in some areas, just really small areas that ruined a bean crop, and then now it's been severe drought. And so they have 3 plantings a year, and the first and second plantings have been practically lost. The second planting should have been in May, and it's lost. The third planting will be in October, and so we'll hopefully something will get planted then. But yeah, there are huge. So the people are losing money in the countryside and coming in.
Sounds almost like urban renewal here, where they rebuild the inner city at the same time that homelessness rises, but you don't see it.
Right. Right. And in Managua, you know, you see a lot of squatters because they're everywhere, but then you don't see them all. And you kind of wonder, where are they all? If you look around Managua, there's the squatter settlements around, but there's I was there in May, and there are 3, maybe 4 new hotels, multiple-story hotels being built. I'm thinking, the tourist industry is not that big. The primary tourists are people that come on delegations like the ones that we sponsor, educational delegations. We stay in a small guest house. We don't stay in, you know, high-rise hotels or fancy hotels. So I'm wondering, who's going to be staying in those hotels? And where is all this money coming from? Drug trafficking is one of the big sources of money, and people have to, you know, launder that money, and so there's hotels being built and all that to kind of help clean the money as it comes in through the drug trafficking. And it's great increase in the use of drugs. Also, you imagine if people are trafficking it, there's also going to be use of it. And also an increase in gangs in Managua. Violence in the 1980s in Managua was never an issue. People could walk in the streets in the middle of the night, and now it's dangerous to be in some parts of Managua during the day. I mean, that's not so different than many of our large cities, but it's a great change for Nicaragua. And so what is the government's, the Nicaraguan government's plan, economic plan for Nicaragua? Free trade zones. That's the basic plan. As Aliman said, I want to make Nicaragua one big free trade zone. What's a free trade zone? It's an area, right now there's, you know, in particular one large area in Managua where factories can come in, they don't need to pay taxes, they pay very low rents, if any rent at all, they pay very low rates for utilities, and they put together, they assemble clothes primarily. That's for most of them. There's about 18 factories there now, and most of them are for assembling clothes. If you check your clothes, see where they're made. So they might have been made in Nicaragua, and they pay no taxes and they pay no export or import taxes. They bring in almost all of the inputs from outside. Maybe the cloth was manufactured, probably not in the United States anymore. Maybe it was manufactured in Malaysia and then brought to Nicaragua for cutting and assembly, and ship back to the United States. And then they ship it back to Nicaragua and charge full price for it. So they call it, like, there's no forward or backward links then in economic terms. So there's nothing that they really contribute to the economy there, and there's nothing they really buy from the economy there. The only thing that they offer is employment for the highly unemployed workforce there. And the minimum wage for work in the free trade zone is $3.85 a day, not an hour, a day. Most days start at 7 a.m., and if you're lucky, they might end at 5 p.m. You get a half hour lunch break during that time, which actually ends up to being about 25 minutes. And I've visited the free trade zone a couple of times, and so you see people. I was there at lunchtime once, and the 12 o'clock bell rings, people flood out the door. So the most nimble people get out first, and they have to bring their own lunch, and then they sit in the hot sun on long benches, and they eat their lunch, and then they go back in and be back at their places at 12:30 on the dot. The conditions vary within the factories about how bad they are, but there's ventilation problems, health problems are created. And it's just, it's not a place that offers a lot of hope for people to improve their lives. It's, you know, they don't have many other choices. And so if you're a young woman and you're a single mother and you have three or four kids, what are your options? You know, that might be your only one.
Is that about the same as what we read about the situation in Korea with Nike?
Yep.
Going in and having all these Koreans sweat labor?
Right.
Well, they're beginning to bring that about so people are aware of what's going on.
Right.
Do you think maybe eventually things like this in Nicaragua, what's going on, will be surfaced, how they're being misused and treated?
Yeah, you know, there is growing awareness, and because of there's been a lot of focus on Nike. And that's helping to raise awareness about everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just be aware of where our clothes are made. And talking with people in Nicaragua, they said, we don't want to boycott. Don't boycott us because we need our jobs. But, you know, when we ask you to, and there's different networks that are in place, when we ask you to, would you write letters to the Ministry of Labor? Or would you write letters to, like the owner of this factory, or when you write letters to JCPenney because they buy from this factory. So there are networks that are going on. You know, Nicaragua is probably one of the better situated countries for the workers. Then it's better off than Mexico. The workers in the free trade zones are generally better off in Nicaragua than they are in Mexico, because the labor code in Nicaragua, although it's not always followed, obviously, is much better than it is in Mexico. So if the labor code was enforced and followed in Nicaragua, it wouldn't be so bad. There are 8 unions right now in the free trade zone in Nicaragua. So,
of course, on the flip side, they'd say, well, if we weren't there, they wouldn't have anything. So they do have
that
much better off.
Right, that's what the idea is. But I guess, why do those have to be the only two choices? You know, if Michael Jordan gets paid millions of dollars to promote Nike shoes, and he doesn't have to hardly do a thing but smile for the camera, then why should a young kid in Indonesia or wherever get paid a couple dollars a day to make? There's something wrong with that picture, and there's something wrong with JCPenney making, you know, millions and billions of dollars of profit a year, and they can't pay their workers a fair price. So, you know, it's right that they're providing employment for people who would otherwise not have anything. But, you know, we lose out because our factories, our textile manufacturing companies are shut down here. Oshkosh Bagosh comes from Wisconsin. Comes from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. But the last factory that was assembling clothes in Oshkosh, Wisconsin was shut down. I think it was this year or last year.
Because of
the competition. You can, why pay, you know, $7 an hour when you can buy $3.50 a day? So that's the basic thought process there. Well, let's talk a little bit about the church then. So what role does the church have in Nicaragua right now? It's interesting that in the 1980s, the Catholic hierarchy, the church was very much opposed to the Sandinista government, and opposed, there were a number of Catholic priests that were ministers within the Sandinista government. The Ministry of Culture, the Ministry of Finance, I believe, and Ministry of, I forgot the other ministry. There were three Catholic priests that were heads of those departments. And the Pope chastised publicly one of those ministers, Ernesto Cardenal, who was the Ministry of Culture at the time, Pope visited in 1986, I think it was. Ernesto lent him kiss his ring, and he pulled his hand back and shook his finger at him. However, so that was the Pope's position on the involvement of the church with the state in the 1980s. And I don't mean to speak, negatively about the Catholic Church, but this is what's happened, and I think it's important that people know that. But in the 1990s, Cardinal Obando y Bravo, the cardinal of Nicaragua, was very much in support of Arnaldo Alemán, and he let it be known in a variety of ways, including in a mass that was said just days before the election, and all campaigning was supposed to have stopped several days before the elections. He gave a sermon, and he wore rojo sin mancha, all red vestments, which were not of the liturgical season at that time, because that was the color of the Liberal Party. And then he gave a sermon. He had Arnaldo Alemán read the passage that said, and the part of the passage was, "I am the elected one. I am the chosen one." So there's a powerful message right there. And then he gave a sermon that was very clearly talked about the red and black snake, and red and black are the Sandinista colors, and how don't let the snake bite you a second time. And so very clear messages from the pulpit of the cardinal against the Sandinistas and for Arnaldo Alemán. There was also back behind the doors deals that basically everybody in Nicaragua knows about, was that if the church supported Alemán, he would guarantee him the heads of a couple of ministries. So Humberto Belli, who was the Minister of Education in the early 1990s, was also reappointed. And then he was also given the Ministry of Health. So the Catholic Church plays a very strong role.
What about the home-based communities?
The Christian-based communities were very strong, a very important part of the positive changes that happened in the 1980s. They organized whole communities and looked at the gospel through their own eyes. And so there's something very popular called the Gospel of Solentanami, which talks about the gospel and puts people in their own community into the gospel itself. And they organized things that helped the communities, feeding centers and schools. It was very much part of the whole community. And in the early 1990s, the cardinal started replacing the priests that had been leading those communities, moving them out, putting them in communities that were not supportive of that type of approach, and putting in conservative priests into those Christian-based communities. So really trying very hard to break up the Christian-based communities.
Has it been successful?
It's been more successful than we'd like to think, yeah.
My main contact was with several of these communities in the Jalapa area.
In the Jalapa area?
Yeah, they were still really quite strong, but there was no priest.
Yeah. There was a priest up there, Jack. I think his name was Jack Moynihan, actually.
Oh.
Did you know him?
Yes, I think we met him.
Mm-hmm. A U.S. priest that was based there and did some great work, and so...
Yes, from... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there are some. And that was one.
And he wasn't with the Nicaraguan church, though, was he?
No, mm-mm. He was a Mary Knoll.
Yeah.
So through missionaries, Mary Knoll in particular, there have been still some priests with that type of approach to theology that have been placed around the country. And there's still good things. I mean, the church is doing some good things on the grassroots level, but the hierarchy of the church is not supportive of that grassroots work. And so, anytime you try to support something from the ground up that's not being supported by the powers that be, it's just fighting against the current. Good things get done, but it's hard.
Do you know about the group from Kakana?
From where?
Kakana. My nephew's organized a group to go to Nicaragua the last 3 years, and he sent the Kakana newspaper clipping telling the story of what they've done. And his approach, He is Catholic, but the group, because there were different skilled people, and a doctor, a dentist, I think, mm-hmm. That I think their feeling is to not be concerned about the politics, because they feel that the people themselves are the losers either way. And he said that this last time they brought electricity to, well, I guess that was last year, they brought electricity to a village. And they just do these pretty major projects. Mm-hmm. And they work with the people in the area. Mm-hmm. And most of them don't speak Spanish. I think they smile a lot.
Yeah. Hand gestures.
And this year, I think they built a church with the people. But they feel, I don't know how they get it organized. Mm-hmm. But I think his feeling, and he mentioned, he wrote in the letter that he had ridden on a plane down with someone who was very political. And by the time he got there from a long plane ride, you know, he felt that that wasn't the route that he thinks. He's very much in dealing with people directly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just like you mentioned about the earthquake, when you went through, regardless of which government was in power, mm-hmm. it seems like in a lot of those countries, the people still skim off. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's quite a large, I didn't know if they were part of the Alliance for Progress, or maybe they're just an independent group. That
right. The Alliance for Progress really isn't in place anymore, but that there's an incredible movement. In the 1980s, it was very strong, and it's less so now, but every time I go to Nicaragua on the plane, there's some group, often from a church, that is going to Nicaragua through a sistering project. Might be a parish to parish, parish to community. Sometimes there's like a city.
I think this is a city thing. It's not just the Catholic Church. Uh-huh. Whoever will go and spend 3 weeks of hard work. Uh-huh. And then I also get a newsletter. I live in Portland, Oregon, and a newsletter from Eagle Creek. I think it's the Collins Group. It's a Methodist church. Mm-hmm. And I've been getting this newsletter. I don't always read it, but it comes regularly.
SafePod Report?
What is it?
SafePod Report? CE?
Yes, that's it. That's it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that part of the national? The headquarters seems to be in this small community in Oregon.
Well, the SafePod is the Nicaraguan Council of Protestant Churches.
Yes, okay, that's it.
So they're based in Nicaragua, in Managua, so okay. Where the headquarters
so
are.
This is the U.S.
Right, so SafePod USA is based in Eagle Creek, Oregon.
Right, that's just a little burg out there.
Right.
And it amazes me that.
Right. What the folks in Eagle Creek do is help distribute that newsletter. So they support SafePod by distributing that newsletter.
So now, is that, are there lots of, is there a lot going on in this country supporting SafePod?
Uh huh. Let me explain a little bit about that, because that's a great entree into some of the work that we do. This loan fund that you've heard talk about, the Jubilee money, is going to the loan fund that we run, that WCCN runs. And it's actually a new loan fund that we're starting June 1st. We call it the NICA Fund, Nicaraguan Credit Alternatives Fund. But it builds on 6 years of experience we've had directly with SafePod. And SafePod is the Nicaraguan Council of Protestant Churches. It's been around for 25 years. It's not only the Council of Churches, but it's a relief and development organization. And it does all kinds of work across the country of Nicaragua. And it receives support from around the world, a lot of European church organizations, and as well as different churches here in the United States. More individual congregations than denominations here in the United States, but Lutheran World Relief does give money to SafePod as well. SafePod has a variety of programs, including peace and reconciliation programs and community development programs. And so they have a community that they work with, and they have all kinds of work that goes into it. And they also have a loan fund that my organization was a primary supplier of funds for 60 years. And so investors from across the United States help support this loan fund. Churches, people from congregations across the United States would go to Nicaragua to visit SAPOD. And SAPOD would take them on trips around the country of Nicaragua, and they would introduce them to this loan fund. This loan fund, which provides people without access to other forms of credit, an opportunity to borrow money and expand their businesses. Where SAPOD was getting the money was from investors, people like us, primarily. Over the years, we channeled almost $6 million to Nicaragua. Right now, we have $2 million on loan to SAPOD that they have lent out to people around the country. And people lend as little as $2,000 and for as short as 2 years. And so people are supporting Nicaraguans in this way. Coming and through connections with SAPOD. I'll take a few minutes now then to explain how this loan fund works, and some of you who are yesterday have already heard it, but I just want to make sure that people understand how this loan fund works, and then I'd like to hear from you, all of you too, if you know of other work that's being done in Nicaragua. I know you've been to Nicaragua recently, so you can maybe give some examples as well too. But the NICA fund then is very similar to this other loan fund that we've operated, and I'll just talk about it as kind of in one thing. People lend to us, people like you and me, to WCCN. We put that money while we're waiting to lend it then to Nicaragua in South Shore Bank, which is a community development bank in Chicago. So we'll use that money while we're waiting to lend it to Nicaragua. They use that money for supporting small businesses and low-income housing in Nicaragua in Chicago. Then we are in the process of choosing two or three organizations in Nicaragua right now, including SAPOD, we'll be looking at, to lend to. And then these organizations lend it on to a variety of borrowers. Examples of the borrowers there might be that have received funds through the Nicaraguan Council of Protestant Churches include Estela Padilla. She was part of a solidarity group in Managua. A solidarity group where like five women who get together. They don't have any collateral to offer for a loan, but they say, we have our own small businesses that we want to start. And so, say the four of us are going to be in a solidarity group. And if Julie doesn't pay her loan, then the rest of us have to make sure that loan gets paid before any of us can receive a new loan. So Estela Padilla was part of a solidarity group. She received $100 or so to start her business of repair of electric domestic appliances, so like fans and radios and irons and things like that. She would go to the dump, the city dump, pick up scraps from there and fix them, or people would bring their equipment to her and she would fix them from what she had salvaged from the dump. And with this money, she was able to expand her business a little bit more, buying other parts that she couldn't find in the dump and helping her neighbor, providing a service for her neighbors. And she paid back a loan and got another one. She's been able to expand her business somewhat that way. So improving her life and providing service for people in her neighborhood. Another example is in Jalapa region. CCHA, it's like the community cooperatives of agricultural cooperatives of Jalapa. It's a group of cooperatives, and together they received a fairly large loan, I think $50,000, that they then redistributed through their members for producing basic grains and some small cash crops, so that they could improve their lives. Now, for a small agricultural producer to get a loan in Nicaragua is nearly impossible. So this loan fund was providing some of the few agricultural loans, especially in the region like Jalapa, which is a very rich agricultural region, but it's far removed from Managua. Jalapa is up here.
It's a long ride.
It's a long ride. I've never been there. It's far. And so, you know, there's not many bank services out there, but they got a loan and then acted as our own bank.
And that's crucial because back in the, I'd say around 92, they started centralization. Mm-hmm. And what they began doing was closing the banks in the smaller areas. Right. And policies changed so that people could no longer get loans.
Right.
At the same time, they were beginning to take land back that they'd done in the Land Reform Act.
Mm-hmm.
So that even those that had land couldn't get loans to plant a crop.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the poor who had gotten back small parcels of land had no way to keep it.
Right.
Without the small loans.
Right. Exactly. And the National Development Bank, which is the bank you're talking about that they were closing, that's completely closed now.
Yeah.
So nowhere in the country are there any loans offered through that bank, which was the exact bank that the government had set up to serve those people.
Yeah.
So there's no banks offering loans to agricultural producers right now. But there are alternative credit programs, like the CEPAD Fund, and like another fund called Lead La Pond that's run by the Jesuit University in Managua. So how can a person like you participate? Let's say Julie has an extra $2,000 and she wants to invest it in our fund. So we do some paperwork, I give her prospectus, she reads it, she fills out that, we exchange loan agreements and promissory notes, and she sends us $2,000. A year later, she gets an interest check for, she say she's chosen 2% is how, the amount of interest she wants to earn. So she'll receive $40 then of interest. And then another year later, she can choose to roll over her loan, reinvest her loan, or receive it back. That loan has gone to Chicago first for a short period of time and then gone on to Nicaragua where it's been used perhaps. I mean, we won't be able to track your $2,000, but it might have been used by women's solidarity groups like I just mentioned, or maybe an individual wants to start a taxi service, or somebody's starting their own bakery in Estelí, and then it gets paid back with interest, paid to the CEPAD fund, and then paid back to us with interest, and then we pay it back to you with interest. So that's how that loan fund works. And people participate from all across the country. If you don't have $2,000, maybe your congregation can get together $2,000.
Is that the minimum?
Yes, that's the minimum. No maximum. So do you think big. And we pay from 0 to 6%, depending on the amount, and you can choose. So if you're investing $2,000, you can choose 0, 1, 2, or 3%.
What's the rate of payback coming back to the United States?
WCCN has not missed a payment to an investor. We've been on time and in full for all of our payments. But just a second. But in Nicaragua, you know, we have not lent yet through the NICA fund. CEPAD has not missed a payment to us, so we can pay back all of this. But some of their borrowers have not paid back, so we're looking at about 90% repayment, about 10% default rate. They have equity money and loan loss reserves, as do we, to help prevent those losses reaching the investors.
Did I understand you say a person, when they decide they'd like to invest in something like this, they can decide whether they are only going to ask for a 2% return, but someone over here might say, well, I'll do it when I want 4 or 6%.
Right, depending on the amount you invest.
Then when you take that money that you're paying 4 to 6% on, are you going to put that in something that's a little more of a risk because they're getting higher interest than the one that's
It all gets mixed together.
Okay.
So if Julie's getting 2% and you're getting 6%, her money helps, you know, bring down the cost of your money for us. So it helps keep it more affordable for us to run, more and for the other people, the end borrowers. Actually, the lower interest rate, if you choose 0%, say Dwayne wants to invest at 0% because he wants the solidarity, women's solidarity group to get, you know, should we see if we can knock off a couple percentage points on the interest rate we charge them? We can't do that. It doesn't necessarily get passed on to the end borrower. Because issue for the end borrower is not so much the cost of the money, I mean, we try to keep it affordable, but it's the access to the credit. And we lend it to an intermediary that then lends it on, and we let those intermediaries set the interest rates. Because if it's a low interest rate, if it's too low, it'll attract people that could get a loan from the bank, but it looks more attractive to pay a lower interest rate from this alternative program. Oh, we're out of time already. Thanks so much for coming. If you have any other questions about this loan fund, about the other work that we do, which includes the Women's Empowerment Project that focuses on exchange of women, women have an opportunity to exchange ideas, strategies, experiences, especially in the area of domestic violence or other areas of violence against women. I'd be happy to talk with you, answer any questions. If you didn't get any materials, I have some materials up here, particularly on our loan fund. We have some on our women's project. Happy to give it to you. So thanks so much for coming and for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you.